This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Benchmark Maps. Unsure what to gift your adventure-loving friend this holiday season? Inspire them to discover a new state in the American West with a Benchmark Maps Road and Recreation Atlas. Be it Alaska or California, Nevada or New Mexico, Benchmark Maps come with all the information they'll need to plan their 2019 travels, like parks and monuments, campgrounds and RV parks, boating and fishing access, and more. And they're field checked for accuracy, so you'll know you're pointing them in the right direction. Learn more at benchmarkmaps.com and use coupon code SHEEXPLORES for 20% off your order. That's SHEEXPLORES, no space. Benchmarkmaps.com. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores.
Well, I think having that positivity, bottom line, for no matter what situation you get in life, like, it'll just affect everything else in your life. If you're just like, okay, well, you know, I didn't get the raise I wanted, or like, they didn't have Curry Tuesday at the co-op, but it's not the end of the world. It's just what it is. And I'm so happy that I get to do all the things that I get to do every day and be with the people that I get to be with. So it's definitely something that I wish more people would gravitate towards.
This is Lydia Sturgis, and as you'll hear in her laugh throughout our conversation, she's a very positive, optimistic person. And looking on the bright side helped her when she got lost a couple of months back with her climbing partner after summiting Granite, the highest mountain in Montana. As we'll hear in this episode, it's not hard to get lost in the outdoors, but it is preventable, and it's most always worth it.
The more calm somebody can stay and avoid panic, then you're able to make more clear, rational decisions. Because once you become panicked, you ultimately do run a higher risk of injury, hypothermia, things along those lines.
This is Krista Elkins. Both Lydia and Krista call Bozeman, Montana home. Krista's lived there 14 years and lived in Hawaii and Arizona before that. Krista is a paramedic and a nurse.
She's badass. Like, I can't describe her any other way. Like, she's a really cool person. And the second you were talking to me about, like, we should have somebody talking about, you know, what to do in situations when you are lost, I immediately thought of her.
I work on a ground ambulance service in Bozeman, Montana. I also work in an emergency department at a hospital about an hour outside of Bozeman. And then my full-time job is actually working on a critical care emergency medical services helicopter that services the in and around Yellowstone National Park area. So I'm a certified critical care paramedic, certified flight nurse. We do have the opportunity to participate in a lot of search and rescues in the area, which is really amazing. I am a certified wilderness advanced life support provider, and I am no longer teaching, but for many years I taught wilderness medicine as well for a company called Wilderness Medical Associates.
Krista's expertise is going to come in handy later in this episode. Lydia is sharing her experience of getting lost, and Krista is sharing best practices. While you listen, keep in mind that everyone does the best they can when they get into precarious situations. I don't want you to hear Lydia's story and think that I'm holding her up as an example of what not to do. In fact, a lot of what she did was right. I simply want to include Krista as a resource that we can all learn from. We'll hear more from Krista, but first, let's get to know Lydia and her story. Lydia grew up in Asheville, North Carolina, where she felt the same way that she does now. She wanted to spend time outside and learn, which drew her to the Boy Scouts.
So my brother was in Boy Scouts, and he's older than me by like a year and some change. And so, of course, by like, I don't know, natural instinct, I was like, whoa, what's Girl Scouts? If there's Boy Scouts, there has to be something else for me. And so I looked into it and immediately was turned off from it. I think I didn't like what they were teaching, and maybe I didn't look into it hard enough, but it was something that I had gone to the meetings that the Boy Scouts had done and gone on trips with them and kind of was like, you know, this is more up my alley. I'm just going to do this. I would much rather spend the night in a bat cave and explore, you know, boundary waters and learn to fish and just camp and just be in the outdoors and be dirty.
And your mom kind of organized something. It was like the Adventure Girls.
So she, I think, really wanted me to connect with girls my age and, you know, the mothers that were a part of that group as well. Like, we would just go to like the botanical gardens and have picnics and go on hikes and everything. But yeah, the Adventure Girls, it's probably like seven or eight girls. And we would just get together and do things outside. And so it was kind of a way for us to do what Boy Scouts do. I know it was very interesting, but it was super, I mean, it was great, but I, again, kind of immediately still gravitated towards Boy Scouts, and I never did like got badges or anything like that, but I learned how to tie knots and, you know, how to camp essentially and build a fire. And, you know, obviously those things have been crucial to my life now.
These skills have helped Lydia's career as well as her personal life.
I grew up from 15 through college, and even when I moved out here, I've been working in backpacking stores surrounded by gear, and ultimately kind of grew this love for the outdoor industry.
Today, Lydia works for Oboz, a hiking boot company. She started climbing this spring, first in a gym and then outdoors. She met her friend Artie a little after that.
He's been a really good friend. My current roommate and like really close friend Luke introduced him to me when he was leaving town to go be a Boy Scout leader at Philmont, New Mexico. And basically was like, you should climb with Artie. And I was like, okay, because he was abandoning me. So I had to get a new partner. And you typically have anywhere from 10 to 15 quote unquote climbing partners, but like four of them are the ones that you're like, okay, I trust you, I'll climb with you. Because you develop this relationship with them over time climbing, which is such a big relationship of trust and, you know, accountability, and it's pretty intense.
So this next reference you might not get unless you watch a certain cartoon, but I think it's telling about the dynamic between Lydia and Artie.
I would describe him as the male version of Tina Belcher off of Bob's Burgers. He's very soft-spoken, but then there's this underlying wit that comes out. And that was very crucial to this experience on Granite, because we were totally like just fine the whole time. We were frustrated, but like as far as like talking to each other, it was fine, like, you know.
So which character from Bob's Burgers do you most identify with?
Oh gosh, definitely Louise. I'm 100% extroverted. I'm loud. I maybe I'm freaking
Linda.
Yeah. I'm definitely Linda. I'm like a little bit, I'm mostly Linda with a taste of Louise, because I think my younger inner child would say I was Louise, but I'm definitely Linda. Oh my gosh, I'm totally Linda. So
he's a good balance to you, and that's a good thing on the trail.
Yeah, it's very important, and especially when you're climbing too and hiking as much as we did, because we took the longer route up to Granite Peak, because there's East and West Rosebud, and East Rosebud is like 9 miles to the plateau, and the other one is like maybe like 5. It's significantly less.
So what made you want to climb Granite Peak?
Honestly, it was a kind of a spontaneous thing. It was a Thursday, and we had been talking about climbing routes that are pretty iconic around Montana. And all of a sudden, we were making plans to go climb Granite that weekend. And even the next morning, we were like, were we feeling really ambitious last night? Like, what happened? And so we kind of were like, no, but we totally are capable of doing this. I kind of did a little research on it. He said that he had been looking into doing Granite for a long, like, couple years. And so I felt confident going on the trip with him. And, you know, just from my experience climbing with him already, I knew it was going to be a good time, like, you know, full belly laughs and just complete, utter fun.
So would you say that Granite Peak is like a technically challenging hike and climb?
It depends on who you're asking, almost, because you ask somebody who's never hiked that far or climbed something that tall, even if it is easy climbing, like class 3, class 4, and class 5, because you start to get into your grading scale in the climbing world at class 5, and Granite is rated from class 3 to class 5. So you're definitely doing more scrambling, but there was definitely some climbing that we did, but there are parts of it that were difficult, but the whole thing as a whole, I mean, it was totally just fun and long and more of an endurance test than it was anything else. It was a long approach, and there were a lot of different elements that we came across, like snow and high winds and temperature droppings and animals and loose rocks. That was kind of weird. So it was definitely a lot of different elements. And the ultimate thing was just, it was beautiful out there. Mm-hmm. I would do it again.
So you two hiked up and you camped at the flat point, the pass.
Yeah. So when you hike up East Rosebud, you kind of cap out on this plateau that, you know, you have to kind of hike up towards where you start to kind of traverse to get to the base of Granite. We hiked up 9 miles. We were both kind of tired at that point because we had hiked in a thunder and lightning storm. Like we were literally, it was just downpouring the whole time. And I remember at one point we were both hoods on hiking, just like head down, and it cracked lightning around us. And then we both stopped, we froze and waited for the thunder, and we were both counting. And we were like constantly checking in with each other. Like, how do you feel about this? Are you feeling safe right now? Like, you know, standard with thunder and lightning storms, you should just get on the side of a mountain or like find some kind of, you know, shelter to be kind of off, you know, the point of striking. And so that was kind of like a thrilling part of the hike in. And then we start to get closer and closer to this plateau, and it starts to clear up, and then all of a sudden it's just gorgeous. And I mean, you're overlooking Mystic Lake. It was, you know, definitely one of those moments, to not to quote one of your prior podcasts that I've been listening to at work, but like, it was one of those moments where I was like, oh my gosh, out here, I'm enough. Like, this is great. Holy cow. And then you start to kind of head up to find camping, and it's over rocks. Like there'd be like these little lines of rocks, and then there'd be grass that had water underneath it. So it was mushy, mm-hmm. kind of just felt, it was like a moon bounce room that you're walking on. And then we finally found a really cool place that had water running by it. It was really high up. It was about 10,700 feet that we camped at.
What ways did you guys set yourself up for success on this hike and this climb?
We packed as minimal as we could. Like I think I probably wore the same outfit all weekend. We brought things that were more important. Like I am a big person on bringing extra socks. We communicated way beforehand, like who was bringing what. Like I had the stove, he had the tent. I had, you know, making sure that we had all the appropriate gear before we left town. And then ultimately just being on the same page about what our expectations were for this trip, as far as the day of that we did Granite, like if we don't get to the summit by this time, regardless, we'll turn around.
Did you have some type of like spot device or?
So he had on a very fancy Suunto watch that gave off elevation, latitude, longitude. I think it connected to his phone. And a satellite is just a giant watch. And he had saved the Beartooth range where we were hiking in his phone, like on like Google Maps or something. And it was constantly tracking us. So like we could pull it up and like, okay, like we have this far until we get to this point, or be able to look at like the topographic area that we were in. And then my phone, I kept on airplane mode to, you know, reserve the battery. It was just kind of there for pictures and, you know, backup if need be. So if need be happened, there's all these cool pieces of gear on the market for GPS and ultimately survival and safety. I think it's kind of something that's not talked about enough. Like that industry, that market, having those pieces of gear, even like a basic compass is not even talked about a lot anymore for basic survival skills. And so it's very interesting that like those are things that I now wish I would have had. And maybe you have to get lost to realize that those are things that you need, and kind of, you know, hopefully bounce back from whatever experience you have.
We'll hear more after this. Outdoor Voices is an active apparel company that integrates fun in everything they do. To them and to me, harder, faster, stronger isn't necessarily better, but getting outside and being active is the important part. And they make apparel for men and women that makes it easier to do just that, and to look great while doing so too. They also bring people together with events around the country. Right now, I'm wearing their Terra knit leggings, which are keeping my legs nice and cozy as it's getting chillier outside where I live. The knit looks a lot like a mountain's topography, which is both cute and a good reminder to step outside whenever I can. For 20% off your first order of $100 or more, visit outdoorvoices.com/explorers and enter explorers at checkout. Shipping is free and returns are really easy. Again, that's 20% off your first order of $100 or more by visiting outdoorvoices.com/explorers and enter code explorers at checkout.
So we woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
At this point in the story, Lydia and Artie are waking up the morning of the Granite Summit push.
We made coffee, ate breakfast, decided that we were going to leave our tent there because we didn't want to haul it all the way to Granite. It made our pack really bulky. And when you're climbing, it's just like one less thing to just weigh you down. And so we woke up at 4 a.m. and started to hike, and it was in the dark. The sun didn't come up until like 5:45, 6. And we had ran into these two guys that had done Granite the day before, and they gave us kind of a recommendation on, because there were these two snowfields like right above where we slept, and they were like, just stay below them and kind of go kind of right, stay right. Mm-hmm. So we basically kept going. We kept running into Karens, which Karens were very, very crucial on this trip to kind of direct you to where to go next. And we just kept seeing those or running into them. So we were going the right way. And then once the sun came up, we knew exactly where we were, and the hiking and the scrambling across like this giant, I mean, just imagine like a hill, like a pretty steep hill, completely covered in rocks. And there were cairns all along the way, and there was a path. You would just kind of traverse across this entire rock field, and you'd step on a rock, and it may or may not move. So your quads are firing off like crazy across this entire thing. By the end of it, we were both like, okay, we're done with you. We'll see you in like an hour, but we're done for now. You then have to go up another field of rocks to get to the base of the actual like rock that's Granite Peak. And then you have to kind of go around the edges of it, because there's definitely different routes that you can take to climb up it. Like we came across one, and both of us were like, oh, that we don't have like the appropriate gear for that. That's like trad climbing. Let's not do that. And we had a rope, and we both had ATC devices. We had helmets. We had harnesses. We had everything for climbing. And it was a great day. Everything went right. It was fun climbing. And like, for the most part, we free soloed.
Wow.
I would never I don't know if I could tell my mom that, but she may find out. We, for the most part, we free soloed it. There was only one part that I got myself a little scared, and Artie was above me at this point, and it was a crack that we were climbing up, and we were pretty high up. And it's definitely one of those things that you look down and you're like, okay, I cannot fall right now. And so I, you know, holler up to Artie and I was like, hey, like, I'm not comfortable where I am doing this next move. Can you rope up and get me a rope, basically? And we were both really calm through the whole thing. I was kind of like wedged in this crack in a cave, sitting there for probably like 5 minutes while he set up this like sling around a rock and then threw a rope down to me. And he got me like total. I mean, it wasn't like a high stress situation. It was more like I was trying to calm down my fear. So I was having to take deep breaths and, you know, climb with clarity was something that my dad, I had, you know, sent my trip report to my parents and he just responded with have fun and climb with clarity. So I had been reciting that statement in my head the whole time. I was climbing granite, like from the get go, and it definitely helped calm me down to be able to focus that I was okay. And I trusted Artie to get me the rope in a timely manner and ultimately get me up this difficult part. Cause it was a really awkward, like I was in this crack and then you kind of had to like lean back, like down and then grab up above you, kind of behind you a little bit and then grab another one. And then like, I don't know, I was not comfortable doing it without a rope. And there was no judgment. There was no second guessing. Like there was no like, oh, come on, you can do it. That none of that happened. It was simply, okay. And that's sometimes, especially in climbing or in high stress situations, like that's all you need is to hear, okay. And you can move on to the next part and conquer whatever is difficult in a different way. Doesn't make it wrong. It just is different.
It was tough, but they kept going and summited.
It was gorgeous. We got up at 1 o'clock, took some pictures and ate some chocolate. You know, at the summit, they always have those boxes that somebody has left like a notebook of some sort. And so we just wrote the date and our names and then we got down. It was great. It was just, you know, 15 minutes at the most up there because we knew we had a long trek ahead of us.
Yeah, yeah. You didn't know quite how long it would be.
Yeah, I think hiking in the darkness that morning threw us off for how far we actually had to go. I think we underestimated and then overshot our tent.
After a little celebration, Lydia and Artie rappelled down and started hiking in the direction of their tent. What did you expect to happen next?
Next, we just expected to get across this rock field again that we love so dearly and kind of get up over the mountain and then just basically beeline to our tent. And we were happy, you know, we were full of joy that we had gotten to the top of Granite and we were in good spirits. Going downhill, it's kind of interesting, your attitude and your personality change when you go up and when you go down on a hike. Because when you're going down, you're like, okay, well, I'm going home. And so we were, I think, stoked that we had done it and, you know, enjoying the hike down, basically. We weren't like going slow or anything, but we weren't like speed hiking either. So we expected to get back to our tent probably between 7 and 8 o'clock in the evening because of the long approach. And we knew it was a long one. We just didn't know how long. And so we get back to our tent and then we were going to get the tent and hike down and be done. And that was our expectation, to be back to my car by 10 o'clock at the latest. But you know, back to the tent by 8 before it got dark. And that's unfortunately not what happened.
So what happened?
We were just hiking in what we thought was the direction of the tent. And we were, you know, stopping occasionally to look at the map on Artie's phone. And all of a sudden, it was dark. We really felt like we should have been there already. And we kept being like, oh, it's probably just over that. It's just over that. And all of a sudden it was dark and we kept coming up on cliff faces and it was getting windy and cold. And it was just, I just was like, okay, so this is fun. We didn't feel completely lost at that point. It was kind of like a, okay, well, this complicates things. But you know, let's try.
Yeah.
So we walked around for a while and constantly were stopping and we were getting more and more exhausted, by the hour. I remember hitting a wall finally. And it was, I think at that point it was like almost midnight. Ugh. And I knew that my friends were probably worried and I missed my dog and I was tired. My feet were tired. My legs, every bit of me was tired. And I just felt really defeated. But I also didn't feel completely like I never felt unsafe. Hmm. I was with somebody that was good enough for me at that point that I was with someone.
You said you didn't feel unsafe. Did you feel scared?
You know, I grew up with this like underlying fear of the dark. Like my mom and I used to have to like go out to the car together.
Aww.
Because we just both, there was like sounds and that's what happens is that sounds start to play tricks on you. And so I wasn't scared for my life. I was just like not completely stoked with being kind of blind to my surroundings. And we had headlamps. My headlamp died. That is one lesson learned. And so then I reverted to my phone light. And then I was like, gosh, this is like eating up my battery, like no tomorrow. And then I was getting so close to that being done. I was like, I got to stop using my phone. And so basically Artie and I shared his headlamp to walk across this plateau and try and figure out where we were. And when I shut down, I didn't even ask Artie for like permission or if he thought it was a good idea. I just immediately called. There's like a really cool feature on iPhones that if you like kind of click your on off switch rapidly, it'll do an emergency call. And for some reason I had service. Hmm. And was able to contact search and rescue finally, the Stillwater search and rescue crew, this guy named Chad.
Sounds about right.
It was perfect. And Chad was, he'll appreciate this. He was really chatty. He was more or less, I think, trying to figure out where we were and what direction we needed to head and all of that. But I broke down and called and I don't regret it. And afterwards, I remember asking Artie if he was mad at me for calling them. I don't think I was necessarily sorry. If he were mad at me, I wouldn't be sorry.
Yeah.
Because I knew we were safe, but it was more or less the fact that we were definitely lost at that point. And I thought it was important that I should tell someone.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And you also gave him something called a worry time, right?
Yeah. We definitely had given like friends and family like kind of a worry time and we had definitely surpassed that. And so when I finally contacted them, Artie's watch provided us with the latitude and longitude coordinates of where we were. And I recited that to Chad and he and our elevation, that was, we were at 11,000 feet. And per where we were, we needed to go down to 10,150 feet northeast to find a trail.
Wow.
And we were already exhausted at that point. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my gosh. So you tried to sleep a bit.
Yeah. So we're on this plateau. There's really no shelter. And kind of one funny thing is that we kept coming up on these massive boulders that I thought were tents. And so I was shouting at these boulders, hello, like thinking that they were, you know, tents with people in them, and ultimately my heroes. And so it was kind of funny to get closer and be like, oh no, that's definitely a boulder. And it just made it kind of funny. And the whole time he and I, for the most part, we were hiking quietly and trying to really focus on breathing and our bodies and, like, you know, but we would check in with each other from time to time and be like, how are you doing? This sucks. It was definitely, we were tired, but it was more or less like, are you wanting to stop? Like, there was never any anger in any of our communication. And this is the first time we had done any kind of trip like this together. We had just kind of climbed, you know, recreationally, like outside and in the climbing gym here in Bozeman. And this was the first kind of big trip that we had gone on together.
So eventually the sun came up.
So actually, we hunkered underneath this tree, tried to sleep, and it was on a hill. And when we hunkered, I texted Chad our final coordinates. I was like, hey, we're going to hunker for like an hour and try and sleep a little bit. Here's where we are. Like, I kept updating him as much as I could on where we were. He continued to give me information on, like, okay, from where you are, go here to get to the trail. At this point, we were both, Artie and I had kind of made this decision that we're either going to run into the trail or we're going to run into our tent. And whichever one we hit first, we'll either stay overnight, get up early and hike down if we get to the tent, or if we hit the trail, we're just going to hike down. No questions.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a difficult decision. We just kind of were like, this is what we should do. And so we hunkered down and tried to sleep, but sleeping on a hill is hard. We just couldn't get comfortable, and the wind was blowing, and you start to wonder if there's like an animal lurking behind you. And I remember at 3 o'clock in the morning, I literally had taken everything out of my pack and put my legs like down inside of it to try and block some of the wind. And I had on, I mean, both of us were really well dressed. I had on 4 layers up top, a balaclava, a beanie, gloves, full ski gear, basically. I should have been toasty. But 3 o'clock in the morning on a mountain that's called Froze to Death Plateau, it's just like we were totally going to be cold. And that's exactly what happened. We both started getting so cold that I was shivering with that much clothes on. And I had 2 pairs of socks on. And so I attempted and succeeded. I built a fire, and that lasted all of like 20 minutes because of the wind and there wasn't really much to build a fire with, but I was able to get one going, but it died really quickly because it was like twigs. And yeah, that was fun.
So in certain ways, you're just waiting for the sun to come up again.
I think we were waiting either for that or to regain just some kind of strength to continue searching for this trail, because we just knew we had a lot ahead of us. I had an entire like pack of food in my pack, crowbars and goo, the goo stuff, that the gel, all of that. And I probably ate like 4 of those goo things. It was not great for my digestive system, but he suggested that we start to move again. And I immediately was like, yeah, that sounds great. I would love to move because I think that means I'll be warmer. And it was almost as kind of interesting how quickly it happened, because we started walking and I instantly warmed up. And all of a sudden at like 4 o'clock in the morning, before the sun came up, we hit a trail.
Wow. You were relieved?
So relieved. I mean, the fact that I didn't even know what trail it was, but I was just like, it's a trail. Happy day. At that point, we kind of stopped and looked at the GPS on his phone again and kind of decided that we were on kind of closer to West Rosebud, and our car was at the end of East Rosebud. And so basically we just started hiking towards the east to get down, basically.
The hike down was long, but at least they knew they were headed toward the car.
Yeah, it was incredibly relieving to see a trail and to start to recognize some of the cairns that we were passing, and then a tree that we had stopped and had a snack at on the way up. I recognized that, and I was like, we're going in the right direction. Yeah. And then something interesting that kind of happened on the way down towards probably the last mile to 2 miles that we had left, we were completely quiet. There was no speaking. It was something that we were both just so tired and relieved that there was nothing more to say at that point. We were just on this set mission to get down to the car. And tell you what, I've never been so happy to see a Toyota Camry in my life.
I'll chat with Krista about how to prevent getting lost and what to do when you do, as well as more from Lydia after this. I only learned a few years ago that the vagina is one of the most absorbent parts of our bodies, which kind of blew my mind because I hadn't really been thinking about what I was putting inside of it. Sustain is a brand that's committed to being a one-stop shop for vagina-friendly products, from condoms to lube to period products. And when they say vagina-friendly, they mean organic, vegan, fair trade, sustainably made, and free of parabens, glycerin, and synthetic ingredients commonly found in other brands. I got to try out the Sustain period underwear last week. I wore them on the first heaviest day of my period, and it was really nice knowing I had a backup that had my health in mind. They also make 100% organic tampons, pads, and liners, as well as condoms and lube, all delivered right to your door. Right now, listeners of She Explorers can get 20% off their first one-time order and free shipping when you sign up at SustainNatural.com and use code EXPLORERS at checkout. That's SustainNatural.com, promo code EXPLORERS for all natural, vagina-friendly products that put women's bodies first. We're back. You met Krista Elkins at the beginning of the episode. She's a heli nurse and has a whole lot of experience in the backcountry. But she's still gotten lost in her youth. I asked Krista what it's important to pack for an overnight on a mountain.
You know, depending on, you know, what is your area? Are you in a very urban area? Are you in a rural area? You know, most of Montana, for example, is considered very rural. You know, and what are your plans? Are you going out for a day hike? Which in which case, you know, like you said, you know, what certain gear is often overkill. You know, a day hike, you know, you might not really need to bring anything more than bear spray and some water, which often people actually don't even bring those simple things. But I think anytime you're going out for a more extreme adventure, even if you are planning on it being only a day hike, but you're going to a very remote area or you're going to a high altitude, things along those lines, I think you should always be prepared to spend the night. So that being said, you need to have appropriate gear. You know, you need to have appropriate clothing, you know, wool, polypro, not cotton, and up to the point of, you know, being completely covered with socks and hats and coats and stuff for extreme temperatures, you know, especially in, like I said, this area, you do need to plan for all four seasons, basically any time of year. Having the, you know, ability to feed and hydrate yourself, you know, high calorie food, water filter, things along those lines for nutrition, and simple things like first aid kits, some sort of knife, some sort of heat source, a lighter, fire starters, things along those lines. I think at the very least would be the minimal amount of gear that you should carry every time you go out into the wilderness. You know, you can take that to, you know, if you are planning on spending the night or going to a more remote area, have more survival things like compasses, you know, whistles, mirrors, extra batteries for headlamps, you know, a solar phone charger, things along those lines probably couldn't hurt. That just being a gear thing. I think one of the most important things is ultimately being prepared with the gear that you bring. And I think the other most important thing is to be prepared with knowledge of the area that you're going to. Maps and GPSs and all of that can really only take you so far. I think if you're going to an unfamiliar area, especially an extreme or remote area, it helps to be familiar with the area, and if not, have somebody with you, such as a guide, in all honesty, who is familiar with the area, because it is super easy to get lost.
Would you also recommend that someone, you know, whether or not you're hiking as part of a group or you're hiking by yourself, would you recommend sharing what your route is with another person who's at home, who can kind of expect when you might be home, or something like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's like hiking 101 for sure. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. You should always absolutely let somebody know where you're going. Let somebody know when you expect to be back. And I think a good point with that is actually sticking to that. So for example, we've been on a lot of search and assists where people hadn't made it back by the expected hour. So their loved ones called, you know, search and rescue, and we were out searching for these people who ended up basically deciding to take a different route, or they just decided it's such a beautiful day and they wanted to stay out longer, things along those lines. So that actually definitely disrupts the whole process.
I feel like it would also be good to note that, like, you want to be as aware as you can be as to, like, what your skill level is, right? And, like, what you can do at this point in time. Like, maybe you'll be able to do something else in a year, but to be very realistic, or like you said, hire a guide if you need to, and not feel like you're overstepping for yourself, because it puts others in danger if you put yourself in danger.
It absolutely does. And I think, like you said, being prepared with the area you're going to, the conditions, you know, that you're going to, the sport that you're participating in, absolutely. And ultimately, you know, not just relying on somebody else because you think that they're better than you, or they know more, or whatever. I mean, you should always sit down and have a conversation with them about these things before you go out. Even simple stuff like knowing people's, you know, their strengths and weaknesses, their medical history. It's a very standard thing that guided trips do, is like, here, fill out your history, medical history form, and all that sort of stuff. But I think it's important to even do that with, you know, as laymen, when you're just out with your buddies, for sure, is know each other's strengths and weaknesses and abilities.
It's so easy to not do that too, especially like if you want to feel like you're as prepared as someone else. And it's
absolutely
also easy to, and I've talked about this with other women that I've interviewed or just had conversations with, that depending on who you're with, it's really easy to let someone else kind of take charge if you think that they know what they're doing, or they act like they really know a lot more than you do, and you just kind of handicap yourself that way and handicap the whole group.
Absolutely. Yeah. And my understanding, you know, and that's a perfect example of this excursion that Lydia was on with her friend, is she just assumed that he knew where he was going, and he didn't.
Yeah.
You know, they're both adventurous and were, you know, excited to go climb and do this adventure, but ultimately neither of them knew where they were going.
If you do find yourself lost out on a trail, and say it's getting dark, like it was getting dark for Lydia, what are some of the first things that you should do?
You know, and I would have to say, and even having had personal experience with this situation, Lydia and I were chatting about that, I think that the thing that probably gets people the most is this exact situation where you're out, you're having fun, you lose track of time, and then all of a sudden it's getting dark, plain and simple. At that point, your options are limited significantly. It's so much easier to lose a sense of direction once you lose daylight. And I think this is a good point of where people can go either way. I think one of the most important things to do at this point is stop moving. It's really, 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 really easy to want to continue going in the dark, because ultimately now you're kind of being held against your will. You're like, no, I don't plan on spending the night out here. I'm not doing it. I don't want to. I want to go home. I want to sleep in my own bed. So people will keep moving. And that's often where it becomes dangerous, because then you run the risk of significant injury potentially. I mean, you can't see, you're, you know, at high elevation, you can fall off a cliff and die.
Yeah.
I think stopping for the night is the first most important thing to do. And then obviously along with that, don't panic, which is in itself a huge challenge. I think the more calm somebody can stay and avoid panic, then you're able to make more clear, rational decisions.
So your decision should be to stay still. Is it to try to set up a camp if you have those overnight things, like the layers, the if you do have a bivy.
Yes, absolutely. The number one, and people often think it's more important to like stay, you know, it is very important to stay hydrated, don't get me wrong, but food and water are probably the least of your concerns once you realize that you're in a situation where you're going to be spending the night. Number one most important thing is shelter. The first thing you should absolutely do is try and find some shelter because it's going to protect you from the extremities. It depends on where you are. Where are you? Are you in the desert? Are you in the mountains? Are you above tree line? Are you below tree line? You know, those sorts of things are huge considerations, but to best of your ability, you know, if you have a tent, fabulous. You know, if you don't, then you need to find some sort of cave or some sort of build yourself a shelter with, you know, tree branches and twigs and logs and weeds and, you know, whatever you can find ultimately, because that's going to be the best bet. And then warmth to prevent hypothermia. So building some sort of fire source to keep you warm and dry and protected from the extremities ultimately. And then at that point, you can start thinking about, you know, water and making sure you stay hydrated with high caloric intake, potentially getting help at that point. That's why it can't hurt ever to have like a whistle or a mirror or something with you for when you do actually get some sort of help on the way. Mm. It's really, really difficult, believe it or not, to see tiny little specks down there when you're in a helicopter. If you have some sort of reflective source or, again, a fire, it's extremely, extremely helpful. Something to keep in mind, too, with the whole stay put concept is if you're okay, if you're, you know, you're prepared, you have warm clothing, you have a fire, you have shelter, and it's dark, but you're okay, nobody's injured, and you feel safe, and you know that what you really just need is daylight to make it out the next morning, you know, really consider not activating a rescue because it's dangerous. It's going to be dangerous for the providers who are attempting to come out into the dark to find you. Mm. It's never a bad thing just to, you know, let them know you're okay, but the next morning you'll get a hold of them again or you'll try and find your way out. But trying to get a search and rescue group out to you in the middle of the night, especially in like horrible winter conditions, things along those lines, is ultimately dangerous for the rescuers as well. So now you're just putting a lot more people at risk. Granted, the situation's totally different. If you're injured or, you know, there's a medical emergency or something along those lines, don't ever hesitate. But just something to keep in mind.
Yeah. No, thank you for making note of that, because I imagine it's very tempting if you are able to get in touch to try to get in touch.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Lydia's story, she's fortunate in that it was a 24-hour experience.
Yes.
What if, you know, you are out there longer and you don't have the means to communicate?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And I don't know that there is a right or wrong answer to that.
Yeah.
I think one of the best things that somebody can do, like earlier in our conversation, is let somebody know where you're going, your exact route, stick to that route, which may or may not be possible, obviously, if you're off trail. And when you're expected back, and to let those people know to activate some sort of search and rescue for you. Because if you feel confident in the fact that people are searching for you, the best thing to do is to stay put. Mm. Because there is nothing like running in circles around search and rescue while you're out there and they're looking for you and you keep moving.
Yeah.
We can't find you if you keep moving. You know, people are think, oh, like that's the trail. Oh, I get it now. I can see, or it's daylight, or I'm just gonna, you know, I know my way around. And I've literally seen search and rescue do circles around people who are off trail because they keep moving. Mm. So yes, I would say initially, if you're guaranteed that somebody's coming for you, the best thing to do is to stay put. If you're not sure, or you don't know, or you weren't on your game enough to tell anybody where you were, you're going to have to move. You're going to have to get yourself out of there. But very judiciously, it's going to be a potentially very challenging thing to do because of the fact that you could bury yourself even deeper in the wilderness by doing that. It's going to be important to have some wits about you, some navigational skills, use your compass, use your maps, all of those things. Look for other signs of life, look for cairns, you know, trail markers, all those sorts of things to get yourself out. I mean, there's only so long you could stay out in those conditions and survive, you know, when it comes to food and water and hypothermia and whatnot.
a lot of this comes down to, as you said, like being prepared too, which makes me think, like, are there any wilderness courses that you would particularly recommend that someone takes before setting out on like maybe a more challenging excursion than they normally go on?
You know, there's so many amazing, amazing programs out there these days. Companies like Outward Bound and REI even do so many adventure courses, which one I think would be a good way to help prepare somebody to do adventures like that on their own a little bit more. But if not, then they also provide guided courses too, which as we've talked about is a great option for people, is to actually go out with guides. There's a number of companies out there who do survival courses. I think a lot of them are probably more extreme than the average person would need. But still, heck, why not? If you've got the time and the money and the energy and the intrigue, you know, why not take a survival course like that? I think they'd be very interesting. And then, of course, there are a number of companies who do more like wilderness medicine courses. I don't think it would hurt anybody ever who spends time in the outdoors to have at least a wilderness first aid course and have a practical first aid kit with them. There's an amazing course known as a wilderness first responder course, actually, that is about a week long course that takes the first aid course to a higher level. That depending on your, you know, your groups, your travels, your interests, things along those lines is a fabulous knowledge base to have. Absolutely. If you're out and experiencing medical problems with yourself or your group, as well as potential for injuries.
Yeah. I've also found, at least personally and anecdotally, that going with people who are a little more experienced. So like I have a friend who, and she's through hiked and she's, I look up to her in her, like with her skill level. But I try to do it in a way that isn't like, no, now I'm not going to do anything. It's more, I try to learn from her and just like being open to observing her and thinking about like what I can do on my own. So even though I might go backpacking with her, feeling very independent at the same time. But that's not so much like a formal course, but just trying to be observant when I do go out there.
Oh, absolutely. And for me, and the perfect example is moving to Montana from Hawaii. Like I had to learn about like tucking the back of your shirt in so you don't get a draft back there, you know, like all the simple things, like let alone not wearing cotton and wearing wool and polypro and layering. You know, you have to layer to, you know, keep yourself warm, and you have to be prepared to unlayer because you have to be prepared for all four seasons in this area, even in the middle of summer. Like all of those things was a huge learning curve for me. I didn't take any formal courses on any of that. It was definitely just out being friends and living and recreating with people with a lot more experience than me and learning from them.
Speaking of learning, I asked Lydia what she learned from getting lost in the Beartooth.
I think definitely when you are looking to do a big trip, I think I learned that I need to do a little bit more research and understanding of my surroundings and bring extra batteries. That was definitely something I learned. But I think as far as getting lost, you know, it definitely makes you really plan a little bit better. I'm more of that like spontaneous personality. And so it definitely gave me a more of a desire and drive to plan a little bit. Like there's no such thing as over planning when you're going on a trip in the outdoors, especially. I think as far as understanding what you're going into and where to go and having a really defined idea of what direction to go. Like I just wish that I had maybe like sat down with Artie and we looked at that map before we even started hiking and been like, okay, so we're going to do this, then we're going to go here, and then we're going to go here. And then either taking more survival gear with us, GPS devices, or like communicating on like, okay, if we're going to leave the tent behind, we need to drop a pin here so that we can find it later. Being more particular about the things that you do in the outdoors, basically covering our ass.
That definitely makes sense. Being more deliberate, just you know, taking that extra like 5 minutes to orient yourselves together, like, could potentially save time later.
Yeah, and maybe bring an extra chocolate bar, because that would have been nice.
A little comfort food instead of just goo.
Yeah, I mean, it was chocolate flavored, but ugh.
So when you initially emailed me, you wrote in the email that you felt like getting lost for you was particularly eye-opening as a woman. Do you still feel that way, and why?
Yeah, I definitely think it was a good experience for me to get lost. I mean, it's kind of funny how gender roles play into asking for directions, getting lost, and how each one reacts to it. Hmm. You know, there is that huge, you know, society norm that masculinity, like, we don't ask for directions, and, you know, getting lost is not something that happens. And so as a woman, especially in the outdoors, like hiking and doing this epic trip, like, it definitely made me realize that even if I had a really awesome climbing partner, I still needed to take care of myself and know more about how to take care of myself in those situations. Like, I just felt like I didn't know enough, and that was unacceptable. And I think there are a lot of classes that I could have taken or should take or will be taking on reading a map, using a compass, using like the stars to navigate, I kind of briefly talked with Krista about like kind of the parameters behind this podcast, and she was like, yeah, we had to go through training to be a heli nurse, like, on survival skills, that using like the wilderness around you to survive. Mm. And I think that is something that isn't taught often enough, and a lot of our education system could do a better job at informing people on how to survive when you don't have anything but what's around you. And I wish that I had had a little bit more knowledge to back that. And it was very, it was kind of like scary and empowering all at once. 'Cause I was like, you know what? This really, really sucks, but I got this. And it seems to be the thing that women are doing more and more lately, of this kind of like, oh, I can do that. And be more vocal about it. So I think that was kind of the drive behind wanting to reach out and, you know, share this experience, even if it wasn't, you know, a life or death experience, but share it, because it definitely put me in a vulnerable place with, you know, somebody that I had never been in that space before with. It was kind of cool and interesting, and very, I learned a lot about myself during that whole process to how I react in those situations. So it was kind of cool.
So it can be dangerous out there, but we go out there anyway. I asked Krista why she thinks the benefits outweigh the risks.
You know, you can't always worry about what's going to go wrong, especially when it comes to the outdoors. I mean, I think a lot of us choose to live in areas and live lifestyles that very much involve the outdoors, because I think it helps keep us sane. Mother Nature will be around a lot longer than we will. And she's out there, and it's pretty phenomenal. I think it's good physically, good mentally, spiritually, emotionally, to be outdoors. For a lot of us, it's our church. It's where we go on Sundays, you know? Mm. And I don't think you can always be worried about, you know, the bad things that can happen, because it's just so, so worth the nurturing that you get from being outdoors otherwise. And again, coming back full circle is just to be prepared for any, you know, potential bad situations. I've been carrying an emergency blanket around in my backpack for like 12 years now, and it's mm-hmm. probably expired and maybe no good anymore, but I carry it every single time I go, with a lighter mm-hmm. and a Clif Bar, you know, like, just be prepared. But yeah, you can't stay indoors your whole life.
You know, it was one of those situations that there's nothing you can do about it at that point. And you can either rise above it and take control of the situation and make yourself happy, because it's kind of one of the things that I kind of have focused on a lot in my life lately, of the simple choice of choosing happiness in all facets and adapting to anything that's coming your way and being content and happy with where you currently are. And when you're in a situation, when you're lost in the woods, like, there could be bears around, there could be no food, there could be no water, but you could choose to be frustrated, yes, but you can also choose to be happy that you're in the woods and you're surrounded by, I mean, the stars were up on that plateau were just so incredible. I've never seen that many stars in my life. And I mean, I've been to like 10 Sleep Wyoming, where the stars were incredible there too. And you see a shooting star every like 10 seconds, but it was gorgeous up there. And, you know, it was definitely scary at times, but it wasn't scary enough that I couldn't be happy with where I was. I guess one of the things that I really wanted like your listeners to hear is that getting lost is a very vulnerable place for you to be. And women are really good and really bad at being vulnerable. We have a tendency to shut down when we get into vulnerable situations. At least some women do. I know that's not the same for everyone, and it can definitely depend on the situation, but the way that that whole situation for me was handled, I can't like say it enough. Like, it made me so vulnerable and so strong at the same time. And yeah, I highly recommend getting lost. It's good for you. It's good for your soul to get lost, because you learn a lot from it. Like, just so much about yourself, about how you handle things. Like, it's very good. It's good. It's good to fail, essentially.
The next week, Lydia and Artie went back and found the tent and all the gear they'd left on the plateau. Save for a few mountain goats, no one had disturbed it. Thank you to Lydia for sharing her story with us. We'll share stories of her hike with Artie on a landing page via she-explorers.com/podcast. Thank you to Krista for sharing her knowledge with me and our listeners. I'm going to pack a mirror from now on. Thank you to our sponsors, Benchmark Maps, Sustain Natural, and Outdoor Voices. All discount codes are listed on the show notes and episode landing page. If you enjoy She Explores, please take the time to review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And as I like to say, the best thing you can do is share She Explores with a friend. I'm always recommending podcasts to friends. And if you're looking for a new one, I just started listening to Kind World from WBUR in Boston. It's a really lovely reminder of all the kindness that's out there that can be found between people. Music is by Jason Shaw, Josh Woodward, Lee Rosevere, and Kay Angle, using a Creative Commons Attributions license. Music is also by Sun Shapes. Until next week, have fun out there.